أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. Welcome to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. I am your host, Bill Whitehouse, and my Sufi friends call me Anab. I have been traveling sometimes more quickly and sometimes much more slowly on the Sufi path for over 40 years. I am not a Sufi sheikh, but I would like to use the contents of this podcast as a means of sharing with you some thoughts, ideas, possibilities, values, and principles concerning the Sufi spiritual way. Each edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will feature various selections concerning poetry, essays, readings from traditional sources, and reflections that give expression to different dimensions of the Sufi path. In addition, there also will be several musical interludes included that offer a change of pace of sorts. So relax, melt into the comfort of your chair, close your eyes, and permit me to take you on an excursion through some of the unrestricted regions of the Sufi spiritual path.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
الرحمن علم القرآن خلق الإنسان علمه البيان الشمس والقمر بحسبان والنجم والشجر يسجدان والسماء رفعها ووضع الميزان ألا تطغوا في الميزان وأقيموا الوزن بالقسط ولا تخسروا الميزان والأرض وضعها للأنام فيها فاكهة والنخل ذات الأكمام والحب ذو العصف والريحان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان
The Beneficent hath made known the Quran. He hath created man. He hath taught him utterance. The sun and the moon are made punctual. The stars and the trees adore. And the sky he hath uplifted. And he hath set the measure. That ye exceed not the measure, but observe the measure strictly, nor fall short thereof. And the earth hath he appointed for his creatures, wherein are fruit and sheathed palm trees, husked grain and scented herb. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny?
من صلصال كالفخار وخلق الجان من مارج من نار فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان رب المشرقين ورب المغربين فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان مرج البحرين يلتقيان بينهما برزخ لا يبغيان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان يخرج منهما اللؤلؤ والمرجان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان وله الجوار المنشآت في البحر كالأعلام فبأي آلاء رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ.
He created man of clay like the potters, and the jinn did he create of smokeless fire. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? Lord of the two easts and Lord of the two wests, which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? He hath loosed the two seas they meet. There is a barrier between them. They encroach not one upon the other. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? There cometh forth from both of them the pearl and coral stone. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? His are the ships displayed upon the sea like banners. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny?
كل من عليها فان ويبقى وجه ربك ذو الجلال والإكرام فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان يسأله من في السماوات والأرض كل يوم هو في شأن فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
Everyone that is thereon will pass away. There remaineth but the countenance of thy Lord of might and glory. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? All that are in the heavens and the earth entreat him. Every day he exerciseth universal power. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny?
سنفرغ لكم أيها الثقلان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان يا معشر الجن والإنس إن استطعتم أن تنفذوا من أقطار السماوات والأرض فانفذوا لا تنفذون إلا بسلطان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان يرسل عليكما شواظ من نار ونحاس فلا تنتصران فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
We shall dispose of you, O ye two dependents, man and jinni. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? O company of jinn and men, if ye have power to penetrate all regions of the heavens and the earth, then penetrate them. Ye will never penetrate them save with our sanction. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny? There will be sent against you both heat of fire and flash of brass, and ye will not escape. Which is it of the favors of your Lord that ye deny?
The previous excerpt of the Quran is from Surah 55, Ar-Rahman, the Beneficent, verses 1 through 36, and is recited by Qari Wahid Zafar Qasmi. In many, if not most, of the first seven editions of the Sufi Study Circle podcast, the recitation of the Quran has been followed by a few brief observations. Such observations are not intended to serve as an interpretation of the Quran, nor are they intended to serve as a commentary concerning the Quran. Rather, when reading or listening to the recitation of the Quran, there often are occasions when certain ideas and thoughts come to mind. I refer to such observations as Quranic resonances, that is, something in the recitation or reading of the Quran resonates with something in me, and the observations that ensue give expression to such resonances. Today's Quranic resonance is as follows. Before creation, there was only divinity, and after creation, there is still only divinity. The beneficence of God is endless and without beginning, yet human beings are prone to forgetfulness and therefore need to be reminded again and again. Everything that we have, our life, consciousness, intelligence, talent, creativity, language, understanding, knowledge, the capacity to choose comes from Allah, who encompasses all things and makes all things possible. Modern science and philosophy seek to offer alternative accounts of the universe, but their accounts are problematic because they leave out that which is both necessary and sufficient to make the origin and manifestation of created things possible. We journey, act, think, feel, and accomplish only as God permits us to do so, and what God does not permit is beyond our means to bring about. Our potential is with God and our ends are with God, and it is only God's beneficence that permits our essential potential to be realized, and it is only God's beneficence that will save us from ourselves. We go about our lives and do that which comes into our minds, not knowing how and why the contents of our phenomenology are as they are. Whether we are agreeable or not, all that transpires in our lives will be subject to God's conclusive argument. Blessing upon blessing, light upon light, all is due to the beneficence of our Lord. Whether we are given only a little or we are given much, it is all from God's beneficence. Indeed, which of the countless blessings of God will human beings and jinn continue to deny? This is both a question and a challenge. The title of today's Friday Thoughts is Sam Harris, Majid Nawaz, and the Future of Ignorance. It is the first installment in a multi-part series of commentaries concerning a book recently released by Harvard University Press that is entitled Islam and the Future of Tolerance, and consists of a dialogue between Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz that seeks to be critical of Islam. Sam Harris begins his dialogue with Majid Nawaz in the book Islam and the Future of Tolerance by talking about, quote, the prospects for reforming the faith, end of quote, something that Majid Nawaz is interested in doing. Perhaps, however, what has to be reformed is the understanding of various Muslims and non-Muslims with respect to the nature of Islam. Dr. Harris assumes that he understands Islam, but he provides plenty of evidence in his books that such is not the case. In fact, Dr. Harris is presumptuous in precisely the same way as many fundamentalists are presumptuous, for they both seem to be incapable of considering the possibility that they might be wrong about, along with quite a few other things, their understanding concerning the nature of Islam. At a dinner gathering associated with the Intelligence Squared debate in October 2010, Dr. Harris criticized Majid Nawaz for arguing in the debate that Islam is a religion of peace, which has been hijacked by extremists, because according to Dr. Harris, quote, Islam isn't a religion of peace, and the so-called extremists are seeking to implement what is arguably the most honest reading of the faith's actual doctrine, end of quote. What is the evidence that the, quote, extremists, end of quote, are implementing, quote, the most honest reading of the faith's actual doctrine, end of quote? What, quote, actual doctrine of the faith, end of quote, is Dr. Harris talking about, and on what is he basing his claim concerning the nature of such a doctrine? Moreover, what makes the reading of the, quote, unquote, extremists the most honest one? Dr. Harris proclaims to Majid Nawaz that, quote, someone has to try to reform Islam from within, but the path of reform appears to be one of pretense. You seem obliged to pretend that the doctrine is something other than it is. For instance, you must pretend that jihad is just an inner spiritual struggle, whereas it's primarily a doctrine of holy war, end of quote. What is the evidential basis for Dr. Harris claiming that jihad is primarily a doctrine of war? He just makes the claim. He never backs it up. He never demonstrates how Islam and the Quran demand that jihad must primarily be understood as a doctrine of physical war, and that any engagement of others by Muslims automatically gives expression to holy war. On the other hand, contrary to what Majid Nawaz claims, the Quran should not be understood in terms of the historical context in which certain passages of the Quran were revealed. Rather, while those historical events might have been the occasion when revelation was manifested, the Quran must be understood as a whole, and the application of the Quran must be done in accordance with what constitutes the best way of engaging a given set of circumstances through the entirety of the Quranic teachings, and not just this or that cherry-picked passage of the Quran. The Quran is guidance, not a rule book or a law book. The Quran gives expression to a nuanced, multidimensional, rich, insightful understanding concerning the nature of existence and an individual's relationship to such existence. One must draw from the entirety of that understanding when engaging experience, or one does injustice to the guidance. According to Nawaz, quote, what can unite us is a set of religion-neutral values. By focusing on the universality of human, democratic, and secular values, we can arrive at some common ground, end of quote. This all sounds very good, but it is almost meaningless. While there might be values that are held in common by humanists and Islam, those values are not necessarily religion-neutral because we don't know where ideas come from. Goodness, truth, character, value, justice, peace, harmony, and so on are concepts that refer to issues that have to do with the possible nature of the universe. And until we know the underlying nature of the reality to which such concepts give expression, or what makes one's understanding of such concepts possible, then all one can say is that there are a number of potential points of intersection where non-believers and believers might be able to reach an agreement about how to proceed in order to provide everyone with an opportunity to continue to be able to seek the truth concerning the nature of reality. Just what does Nawaz mean when he talks about the, quote, universality of human, democratic, and secular values, end of quote? Such values are universal in what sense? There are many different ways of parsing such ideas as freedom, rights, fairness, justice, democracy, and so on. The foregoing words might be universally used, however, there are tremendous differences in meanings. It is a Tower of Babel. Majid Nawaz states, quote, religion doesn't inherently speak for itself. No scripture, no book, no piece of writing has its own voice, end of quote. I disagree with him. If I write something, then what is written gives expression to my voice. If Nawaz or anyone else wishes to interpret what I am saying in some other way, then that interpretation gives expression to their voice. Nonetheless, to try to give priority to their interpretation over what I am intending through the writing is to try to deny my voice. Moreover, reality has its own voice. It is what it is. If a given scripture, and this sentence is intended to be hypothetical in character, gives expression to the voice of reality, then in what sense does such scripture not have its own voice? If religion is a process of seeking to access the truth concerning the nature of reality, then in what sense does that reality not have its own voice? And isn't one of the problems that plagues many modes of understanding, whether in the case of religion or the case of science, a function of how people often seek to give priority to their own voice over the voice of reality, and thereby discount what reality has to say? Nawaz goes on to argue that, quote, "I asserted that Islam is a religion of peace simply because the vast majority of Muslims today do not subscribe to its being a religion of war. If it holds that Islam is only what its adherents interpret it to be, then it is currently a religion of peace," end of quote. Deen, or the way of Islam, is neither a matter of interpretation nor a matter of majority vote. One has to be opened up to the reality of deen. One cannot impose one's own ideas onto it. Furthermore, one cannot impose the agreements of a collective set of individuals upon the nature of truth. Although Nawaz wants to challenge, quote, "the narrative of violence that has been popularized by," end of quote, "the jihadists," he is in fact introducing his own narrative into the discourse. In the process, he has deprived Islam of its own voice, the voice that God has given it, and the voice that needs to be heard in order for an individual to be opened up to the essential nature of Islam. The book, Islam and the Future of Tolerance, has a footnote on page 8 that talks about a 2013 Pew poll conducted in 11 Muslim-majority countries and shows that, quote, "support for suicide bombing against civilians in defense of Islam has declined in recent years," end of quote. Nonetheless, the footnote goes on to list the percentages by country, quote, "who still think that this form of violence against non-combatants is often or sometimes justified are sobering. Egypt, 25%, Indonesia, 6%, Jordan, 12%, Lebanon, 33%, Malaysia, 27%, Nigeria, 8%, Pakistan, 3%, Palestinian Territory, 62%, Senegal, 18%, Tunisia, 12%, and Turkey, 16%, end of quote. What does it actually mean when someone says that killing non-combatants is sometimes or often justified? Does it mean that they are prepared to do it themselves? Does it mean that while they wouldn't necessarily engage in such acts themselves, voicing such things is the only option they are being given by the pollsters to express their disagreement with the way that the United States, Britain, or Israel goes about killing people with impunity? Or does it mean that they are angry and therefore they are prepared to say something violent because this is how they feel, but if push came to shove, they would not commit that sort of violence? Unless one can meaningfully and precisely translate the extent to which words can be transformed into certain kinds of acts of violence, then all such polls indicate is someone's willingness to speak the language of violence without necessarily being willing to act out the language of violence. Millions of people around the world, including Sam Harris, use words of violence. However, only a very limited number of those individuals ever put those words into the sort of motion that ends in physical violence. Moreover, what does it mean that, quote, "support for suicide bombing against civilians has declined in recent years," end of quote? Is the decline due to the way in which some individuals have had a chance to reflect on such actions and therefore no longer feel that those actions are justified, even though at some point they might have been reluctantly sympathetic to that sort of behavior? What has brought about such a decline? More importantly, if such opinions can change, then what conclusions, if any, can one draw from an opinion poll, except that perhaps one cannot necessarily be certain of just what those polls are reflecting or tapping into? Relative to the United States, the vast majority of countries in the world that are not in a state of war consist of people who, if given a choice, are not violent. The United States, on the other hand, is one of the most violent countries in the world, both domestically and internationally, and the latter includes the unprovoked invasion of numerous countries around the world, including Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Vietnam, Yemen, Syria, Cuba, and so on, that has led to the death of millions of people. Whatever the shortcomings of the foregoing countries might be, America is more of a terrorist nation than any of the foregoing countries or peoples. America has long been a country that propagandizes about the speck of terrorism in someone else's eye while ignoring the beam of terrorism in its own. While discussing various military conflicts in the world, Dr. Harris indicates that many Muslims viewed some of these operations as being sacrilegious, no matter how evil or secular the target of Western power happens to be. Dr. Harris says, quote, Saddam Hussein was the perfect example. He was a universally hated secular tyrant, but the moment a coalition of non-Muslim states attacked him, much of the Muslim world was outraged that, quote, Muslim lands, end of quote, were being invaded by infidels. As usual, Dr. Harris has got his facts wrong. The several invasions of Iraq by a coalition of countries involved quite a few Muslim nations, and therefore infidels were not invading Muslim lands, but rather the invasion was carried out by a group of countries that in one way or another could be considered to be, quote, people of the book, end of quote, but each of whom had its own reasons, almost invariably bad ones, for invading Iraq. Saddam Hussein might have been a secular tyrant, but the United States was quite happy with him when he was doing its bidding, and among other things, the horrendous Iran-Iraq war. It wasn't until Saddam started to work towards undermining the petrodollar by advocating the implementation of a new gold standard for making oil purchases on the international market that Saddam began to fall out of favor with the United States. While, most murderously, Saddam did gas his own people, nonetheless, it was the West who supplied him with the chemical materials that enabled him to carry out that job. Moreover, Winston Churchill arranged for the Iraqi people to be gassed long before Saddam came up with the idea. And perhaps the actions of the supposedly great icon of British history who got away with such reprehensible actions inspired Saddam Hussein to follow suit. In 1990, the case against Saddam Hussein's tyranny purportedly was so strong that the United States felt compelled to fabricate evidence in order to persuade the Saudis that the Iraqi army was massing along the border to Saudi Arabia, when satellite imagery indicated this was not the case. In addition, in order to obtain congressional permission to carry out a military attack on Iraq, elements within the U.S. government arranged for the daughter of a high Kuwaiti official to lie during a hearing before Congress by claiming, falsely, that she had witnessed Iraqi soldiers taking babies from incubators in Kuwait and smashing them on the hospital floors, testimony that helped turn the tide of opinion within the United States in general and the U.S. Congress in particular, to look favorably upon the idea of military action against Iraq. In addition, let us not forget the role of Ambassador April Glaspie in helping to convince Saddam Hussein that the United States had no interest in Iraq's border dispute with Kuwait. By doing so, the United States misled Saddam Hussein and thereby helped make possible all the carnage that followed. Moreover, one should keep in mind that both George W. Bush and Colin Powell went before the United Nations and put forth manufactured evidence in order to get international approval for the United States' desired illegal war with Iraq in 2003. Indeed, apparently information is now coming out via the email controversy involving former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that Bush, Powell, and Tony Blair conspired to generate an array of false information in order to try to justify their intention to invade Iraq. What is problematic about the United States invading Iraq, both through the 1990s as well as beginning in 2003, is that there was no real justification for such actions. The United States, together with a morally challenged group of coalition partners, invaded a sovereign country without provocation and in the process killed hundreds of thousands of innocent non-combatants. Whatever Saddam's sins might have been, they were his sins and not the sins of the Iraqi people. The United States and its coalition partners perpetrated war crimes against the people of Iraq. Whatever the tyrannical sins of Saddam Hussein might have been, the terrorist actions in Iraq by the United States, along with its partners in crime, were far worse. The United States destroyed the infrastructure of a once viable country, killed its citizens by the hundreds of thousands, many of whom were children, detained and tortured large numbers of innocent citizens in places like Abu Ghraib, as well as in a number of illegal black sites, and helped push the entire Middle East into destabilized freefall. Was Saddam Hussein a terrible tyrant? Yes, he was. But where is the evidence that Saddam Hussein did anything remotely like what the United States and its allies did to the people of Iraq? Dr. Harris states, quote, "One of the problems with religion is that it creates in-group loyalty and out-group hostility, even when members of one's own group are behaving like psychopaths," end of quote. As usual, Dr. Harris frames things in a way that suits what appear to be demagogic purposes. What are the 39 countries of the U.S.-led coalition but an exercise intended to whip up in-group loyalty in order to foment in-group hostility against their out-group target, namely the people of Iraq? Why blame religion for doing what many, if not most, social groups, religious and secular, have done throughout history? Moreover, what is Sam Harris doing by going after religion, if not an exercise which seeks to establish a quote-unquote out-group with respect to those whom he and others who think like him can feel justified in harboring hostilities concerning the members of such a group? Dr. Harris is so busy wagging his finger at religion for making in-group and out-group distinctions that he apparently fails to see that he is engaged in precisely the same kind of activity with his diatribes against religion. The problem is not religion per se. The problem is human beings who use social forms of control, persuasion, indoctrination, and propaganda to create quote-unquote us and quote-unquote them scenarios for reasons having to do with the exercise of power. While referring to Nawaz's distinction between, quote, revolutionary Islamists, end of quote, and, quote, jihadists, end of quote, Dr. Harris refers to a group of Muslims who, quote, apparently wake each morning yearning to kill infidels and apostates. Many of them also seem eager to be martyred in the process. Most of us refer to these people as jihadists, end of quote. Although years ago I employed such terminology myself on several occasions, nonetheless I think there are some problems entailed by such usage. First of all, the primary sense of jihad, the greater jihad, to which the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, referred, is an individual struggle with his or her ego or nafs. This dimension of jihad remains relevant even if there had never been any armed conflicts involving Muslims throughout history. By referring to fundamentalists as jihadists, one corrupts the idea of jihad, even in its minor, lesser sense. While the idea of jihad does encompass the possibility of using physical force to defend a Muslim community, any use of force that does not serve the more basic and greater sense of opposing the machinations of the ego is an inappropriate use of force, and therefore does not give expression to the notion of jihad. The people to whom Dr. Harris is referring are not jihadists. They are narcissistic ideological psychopaths. Like narcissists, the individuals to whom Dr. Harris is referring are deeply enamored with themselves. Like narcissists, those people are incredibly delusional concerning their own sense of self-worth, and they become belligerent towards anyone who does not agree with their inflated sense of self-worth or takes exception with the manner in which they filter reality in accordance with their delusional belief systems concerning themselves and the world. Like psychopaths, the people to whom Dr. Harris is referring have no conscience with respect to either destroying the lives of others or causing others pain. Like psychopaths, such individuals have poor impulse control and have little insight into the problematic nature of their own behavior. Like psychopaths, such individuals are interested only in their own gratification, and they don't care who has to suffer while they go about seeking to realize such gratification. Like psychopaths, the people to whom Dr. Harris is alluding are willing to engage in risky behavior with little appreciation for the consequences that might arise through pursuing that sort of risky behavior. Like psychopaths, such individuals are inclined towards manipulating and controlling situations to serve their own desire to pursue one or another form of self-gratification. Like psychopaths, they tend to use people and then discard them when they no longer serve their purposes. Finally, the narcissistic psychopathy that afflicts the individuals to whom Dr. Harris is making reference entails being ideologically driven rather than being due to some set of biological, social, and or set of psychological conditions. That ideology is thoroughly delusional, and therefore everything they think, feel, and do is filtered through that delusional system of understanding. To refer to them as jihadists, as Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz do, frames the conversation in a way that attempts to give some degree of unwarranted credence to their manner of portraying Islam. Such a usage gives the impression that what they are doing is just one of many possible legitimate ways of engaging or reading Islam. However, there is absolutely nothing in the delusional systems of the manner in which fundamentalists and extremists understand things, or in their manner of conducting themselves, that reflects the teachings of Islam. Such individuals are deeply disturbed emotionally, psychologically, socially, and spiritually. The Quran is very clear, see Surah 2, verse 256. There can be no element of force or compulsion present in the matter of deen or the way in which one engages Islam. Whoever treats Islam as if it were an imperialistic creed that is intended to control the people of the world and to which all the people on earth are required to submit has failed to come to grips with even the most rudimentary teaching of Islam. Islam is, first and foremost, a matter of free choice. Majid Nawaz says that, quote, Islam is a traditional religion like any other, replete with sects, denominations, and variant readings. But Islamism is the desire to impose any of those readings on society. It is commonly expressed as the desire to enforce a version of Sharia as law. Political Islamists seek to impose their views through the ballot box. Revolutionary Islamists seek change from outside the system in one clean sweep. Militant Islamists are jihadists. End of quote. Although many people of faith might have their interpretations and understandings of what is entailed by their approach to religion, one must distinguish between what a religion might actually mean and what various people take it to mean. Again, Nawaz seems comfortable with taking away the voice of religion itself, and this is true independently of whether religion is a human construction or it is something that is given through the nature of reality itself. Muslims and Muslim communities might be, quote, replete with sects, denominations, and variant readings, end of quote. However, Islam is not a function of any of those sects, denominations, or variant readings, irrespective of whether such hermeneutical orientations are considered individually or collectively. To whatever extent a person seeks to impose his or her ideas about Islam on other people, whether through political, legal, revolutionary or military means, then such an approach is rooted in a misunderstanding of the tenets of Islam. However one wishes to interpret this or that passage of the Quran, such passages must all be modulated in accordance with, among other things, the light of the Surah 2 verse 256, and any quote-unquote reading of the Quran that ignores Surah 2 verse 256 will be in error. To the best of my understanding, the term Sharia appears just once in the Quran. In Surah 45, verse 18, one finds, quote, O Prophet, we have put you on the right way, i.e. Sharia, concerning the deen, or way of Islam. So follow it, and do not yield to the desires of ignorant people, end of quote. In Arabic, the noun Sharia refers to a place where animals go for purposes of being able to drink water. The related verb sha'ara involves the act of taking a drink. By extension, both the noun and the verb forms allude to a path, road, or way that leads to a place where one might take a drink. There is another word, shari', that is derived from the same root as the two foregoing terms. This other word refers to a lawgiver, legislature, or one who determines the law, but as well, this term also can refer to a street, path, or way. If one brings all of the foregoing senses into juxtaposition with one another, one arrives at the following sort of understanding. Sharia is a way, path, or means that leads to a place where one will have access to something that, like water, is of existential import. a set of circumstances that reality has organized into a set of circumstances to which the individual, the way, the process of traversing the path, the act of drinking, and the value of what is imbibed are linked with one another. The sense of law that is associated with the foregoing understanding has to do with the ordered nature of existence. God is the one who has arranged reality in the way it is, and God is the one who has created the individual, the path, the water, and that which will happen when that water is drunk. Being put on the right way, Sharia, with respect to Deen or the way of Islam, refers to the process of coming to realize one's relationship with reality's existential nature. Sharia has nothing to do with a legal system intended to control people or society, and Sharia has everything to do with the process of struggling to find and journey along the path that will provide one with an opportunity to drink that which will assist one to realize one's relationship with being. I consider both Dr. Harris and Majid Nawaz to belong to the group of ignorant people with respect to whom the Quran was warning the Prophet against yielding to their desires concerning matters of deen. They toss all kinds of terms about when it comes to Islam, but they have no understanding of what it is that they are doing. Dr. Harris refers to various groups that have analyzed the elections of Muslim-majority countries over the last 40 years and goes on to state, quote, "This suggests that 15% of the world's Muslims are Islamists," end of quote. That is, people who wish to impose their beliefs on others through one means or another. He goes on to argue, quote, "However, poll results on the topic of Sharia generally show much higher levels of support for implementation, killing adulterers, cutting off the hands of thieves, and so forth. I'm not sure what to think about a society in which 15% of people vote for an Islamist party, but 40% or even 60% want apostates killed," end of quote. Even if one were to accept the foregoing analyses and poll results, there is a strange sort of inconsistency between the poll results and the results of election in Muslim-majority countries over the last 40 years. If the so-called Islamists are all about Sharia, at least as they understand it, and if 40 to 60% of the people are in favor of the sort of severe punishments that are mentioned by Dr. Harris, which forms part of what the Islamists are promoting, then why isn't the support for the fundamentalist approach to things up around 40 to 60% rather than holding at roughly 15% for more than 40 years? Conceivably, people respond to polling questions in a way that they think will be least problematic or threatening for themselves and their families. After all, the person being polled has no idea who the person or people doing the polling will talk to about what they hear from this or that individual who is responding to the poll. Better to respond in a fashion that meets the expectations of fundamentalists rather than to say something that might get the individuals answering the questions in trouble. However, for the sake of argument, let's assume that Harris's information is accurate and reflects the actual position of Muslims worldwide. To answer Dr. Harris's question, what I would make of such societies is that Muslim leaders, educational, political, legal, and spiritual, have done a terrible job of teaching their respective peoples about the actual nature of Islam. Let's approach the foregoing issue from a different vantage point. How many people in the United States believe that it was right to kill hundreds of thousands of innocent non-combatants in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite the fact that neither country invaded the United States nor, prior to such invasions, took one American life? The pretext for invading Afghanistan is that its government was giving safe harbor to Osama bin Laden and his followers. However, the Taliban government, at the time of the invasion, said that they would be willing to turn bin Laden over to U.S. authorities if the latter would provide the Afghan government with proof that bin Laden did what the U.S. claimed he did, that is, arranged the attack on the Twin Towers in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington. But the United States rejected that offer. Incidentally, Robert Mueller, who was the head of the FBI at the time of the September 11, 2001 events, publicly stated that there was no paper trail or hard evidence that tied bin Laden to 9/11. Moreover, on a number of occasions, bin Laden indicated during several interviews with media representatives that he did not have anything to do with 9/11. Terrorists often take credit for atrocities irrespective of whether they did them or not. since this is, after all, a way of helping to bring a sense of terror into the lives of the people being targeted. Yet on several occasions, bin Laden publicly disavowed any connection to the events of 9/11. Much of the so-called information concerning bin Laden's alleged involvement with 9/11 came from an individual, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded by the CIA at least 183 times, and whom the CIA would not permit the 9/11 Commission to interview directly. Therefore, whatever information came via Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is completely unreliable and has not been substantiated in any independent manner that is not also substantially tainted with respect to its methodology or process of analyzing the data gained through such methodology. Moreover, even if bin Laden were complicit in some way with the events of 9/11, the United States did not have such evidence at the time it invaded Afghanistan in the fall of 2001. When, prior to the invasion, NATO asked the United States to provide evidence that Afghanistan was involved in the events of 9/11, Colin Powell promised to give NATO such evidence but never did so, and therefore there was no legal grounds for either NATO or the United States to become involved in the Afghanistan invasion, because according to the rules of engagement of NATO, a member country must be able to show hard, concrete evidence that one or more of the members of NATO have been attacked by another country in order for an attack on the latter country to be justified, and this was not done by the United States. Millions of people in the United States were caught up in the fog of war created by the U.S. government and its media puppets during the hysteria and the climate of fear that were generated following the events of 9/11. Vast proportions of the population of the United States wanted Muslim blood, and they didn't care whether the Muslims were innocent or guilty. For example, first Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, during a 60 Minutes interview, and then Bill Richardson, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, during an interview with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now. Both responded to a question about whether or not the U.S. actions in Iraq during the first Gulf War were worth it, given that as many as 500,000 innocent people died there, and especially given that many of these casualties were children. Both of the aforementioned individuals indicated that what had been gained through the U.S.'s actions in Iraq was worth the price that was paid for by Iraqi lives. Unfortunately, nothing was really gained. The world did not become a safer, better, more stable place. Instead, Iraq was destroyed. Millions of people in that country were killed or displaced. The Middle East was destabilized, and the actions of the United States in that region were a primary cause underlying the rise of such psychopathic groups as the Islamic State. One might think that attitudes of people like Madeleine Albright and Bill Richardson could not get much more barbaric. Then, however, one remembers that it was the United States that used, quote, shock and awe, end of quote, as a form of collective reprisals or punishment against the Iraqi people as retribution for the sins of Saddam Hussein, as well as committed extensive acts of torture in locations such as Abu Ghraib and used white phosphorus in places like Fallujah, as well as extensively made use of depleted uranium throughout Iraq, and the latter is deeply implicated in the massive increases in cancer and birth defects that have been recorded among Iraqis. When one recalls such horrors, one realizes that the West is also filled with its share of narcissistic, psychopathic ideologues. The only thing that distinguishes the narcissistic, psychopathic ideologues of the West from their counterparts in various fundamentalist groups in the Middle East is that the West has conducted its psychopathic acts of barbarity on a far, far greater scale than have the fundamentalist groups in the Middle East. And just in case people like Sam Harris forget, as he seems to be wont to do, using collective punishment against the Iraqi people for things that Saddam Hussein did, and or invading countries without provocation and or torturing its citizens, and or using white phosphorus on the inhabitants of such countries, as well as using munitions made with depleted uranium to attack those people, are all in contravention of international agreements. The West likes to think of itself as civilized, but its actions indicate otherwise. One can acknowledge that many, if not most, of the individuals who are members of the Islamic State are narcissistic, psychopathic ideologues, Yet despite all of their terrible, reprehensible, and vicious actions, those people don't begin to approach the magnitude of the atrocities that the United States has visited upon, among others, the people of Afghanistan for the past 14 years, along with the people of Iraq for more than a quarter of a century. And Iraq is another country that had nothing to do with 9/11, except in the power-drunk, delusional thinking of people like Dick Cheney and his minions. Dr. Harris is worried about the number of so-called Islamists, people who supposedly wish to impose their religious beliefs on others, around the world as being in the vicinity of 20%. Perhaps he should be just as worried, if not more so, about the 40 to 70% of Americans, depending on the issue, who have supported and continue to support the militaristic and imperialistic policies of numerous U.S. administrations to actively work to help bring about the death and displacement of millions of innocent people in Korea, Honduras, Iran, Vietnam, Chile, South Africa, Argentina, Palestine, Panama, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, and beyond. The same type of mentality that helped commit genocide with respect to Native peoples in North America and instituted a series of racist policies concerning black people that continues to operate right up until the present time. Martin Luther King got it right more than 50 years ago during a speech he gave in 1967 against the war in Vietnam. He stated that, quote, "The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today," end of quote, "is the United States government." And one might add that the greatest perpetrator of terrorism in the world has been and continues to be the United States government. Dr. Harris vociferously and constantly criticizes, and rightly so, the misguided Muslims who serve as suicide bombers. Too bad he doesn't spend as much time and energy criticizing the far more egregious misguided actions of the United States government when it comes to the dispensing of violence, death, and destruction around the world. From high atop the balconies in Carnegie Hall, you are listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. Poetry is a form of communication that, when done well, seeps into one's mind, heart, and soul, resonating with one's being long after the spoken words have evaporated into the vastness of space. Yet every poem is vulnerable to the possibility of being distorted by the emotional and conceptual filters through which it is received. Moreover, although the foregoing vulnerability is present even when a poem is not translated from another language, the presence of translation opens up the possibility of considerable distortion entering into the way in which the underlying sense of a poem is engaged. Poetry is often filled with allusions, nuances, subtexts, idioms, similes, metaphors, and wordplay that don't necessarily remain intact when revealed within the context of another language. Just as the Quran cannot be reduced to how a given individual translates its meanings, so too Sufi poetry often does not travel intact from one language to another. Thus, for example, what was actually intended in a given passage of Rumi's original text might or might not be captured accurately, partially or wholly, by the way in which a given individual translates such a passage. Every edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will contain poetry that is attributed to this or that Sufi poet. Usually such poetry will give expression to someone's translation of an original text that is written in a language other than English. Rather than trying to claim that, for instance, Rumi meant this or that in a given passage of poetry, especially one that is translated, One might fare better if one did not consider such a passage of poetry as necessarily constituting an authoritative representation of what a given poet, for instance Rumi, believed or understood or meant by such a passage. Instead, take the poetry as an opportunity to enter into a process of critical reflection and exploration concerning oneself and one's own relationship with divinity. Something is true not because someone, Rumi or anyone else, said it. Something is true because it reflects the way things are in some given context or on some given level of being. And poets are often held in esteem because they were able, by the grace of God, to reflect some dimension of that truth in an artful manner. The Sufi poets are leaving behind remnants in their words that are rooted in the phenomenology of a spiritual journey that seeks to travel in the direction of a truth that transcends all words. Use poetry as a point of disembarkation of sorts concerning such a journey. Let the words of a poem induce one to search for the truth, to embrace those words as reminders, filtered though they might be by the perspective of a translator or a listener, that there is a truth for which to search, and that there exists a reality that is waiting to be realized in one's life according to one's spiritual capacity and God's grace. The title of the following poem is The Supreme Station. It was written by Sheikh Ahmad al-Alawi and appears in the book A Sufi Saint of the 20th Century by Martin Lings. O thou who understandest not my words, why speakest thou against me? Thou art empty of the spirit, nor knowest the divinity. Wert thou acquainted with my state, thou wouldst admit mine excellence, wouldst see me amongst humankind as a sun shining on creation. My Lord hath granted my prayer, fulfilled my needs. He guided me, now hath robed me in robes of his beatitude, hath quenched my thirst from a rare cup with draught more precious than the elixir, and raised me to a high state loftier than the Pleiades. If thou seekest me, O saint, question thou the Lord of me. Look for me above all heights. It may be thou wilt light upon me. Exalted, rare, secret, and strange are such as I, for I have found the buried treasure that was mine. All things lie hidden here within me. But thou, what knowest thou of my states, who hast no knowledge of the elect? Thou thinkest within me is a void. Think as thou wilt, since the beloved is mine, I look not to the world. Whatever my detractors' purpose in their opposition to me, my heart is mine, remaineth mine. My senses do I give to them. Since all my days are now unclouded, I count not woes as others count them. Who knoweth God, were he to lose the entire world, would need no solace. The empty soul, the opaque of heart, hath eyes but for this fleeting life. He rusheth blindly into error to amass something in this world, nor looketh to the fated ends of all things, nor to his death's nearness, nor followeth any perfect man, but hath no outlet from transgression, firm fixed in his contentiousness, forever warring against God. May our Lord grant my prayer that I turn towards him ever, be ever welcome. Shield me always and shield all Muhammad's people, and let thy beauty flow over in beatitude, as endlessly as worshippers, as endlessly as saints invoke it. Upon the noblest of the prophets, all his companions and his house, their heirs that guidance give and seek, in every pious human being and holy, my greetings light enfold all these. The following reading from a traditional source is by Abu Hamid Muhammad al-Ghazali. May Allah be pleased with him. It is entitled The Knowledge of God's Management of His Kingdom, and it is from The Alchemy of Happiness, translated by J.R. Crook. Now that the existence of the essence of God Most High has been made known, his attributes and his freedom from the sanctity beyond questions of how and why have been made known, and his immunity from ascription to a locality and the key to all spiritual knowledge of the human self made known, one aspect of knowledge remains, that is, the knowledge of the nature of his management, of his rule in his kingdom, and in what manner it is accomplished. How are such things as his commanding the angels in their obedience to him, the management of affairs by the angels and sending of commands from heaven to earth, the movement of the heavens and the stars, the tying of affairs of the earth's inhabitants to the heavens, and the entrusting of the key of sustenance to heaven carried out? This is a tremendous chapter in the spiritual knowledge of the Creator Most High. It is called the spiritual knowledge of the acts, as much as earlier we spoke of the spiritual knowledge of the essence and the spiritual knowledge of attributes. The key to this, too, is the spiritual knowledge of the self. If thou dost not know how thou rulest in thine own kingdom, how canst thou expect to understand how the ruler of the universe manages affairs? Firstly, come to know thyself in one of thine own activities, say, for example, writing. If thou wishest to write the words, quote, in the name of God, Bismillah, end of quote, on a piece of paper, first the desire and will to do so appear in thee. Then a motion and movement occur in thy heart, not the outward heart of flesh situated towards the left side of thy breast. A tenuous substance moves from the heart or soul and travels to the brain. This tenuous substance is what the physicians call spirit or ruh, and it carries the powers of perception and motion. This is a different spirit from that which the beasts also have and which is susceptible to death. That different spirit which the beasts do not have we call the soul, dil, and it never perishes. It is the seat of the knowledge of God. So when this spirit reaches the brain in the image of, quote, in the name of God, end of quote, has been found in the repository at the front of the brain, which is the location of the faculty of the imagination, the result is transferred from the brain to the nerves which come out of the brain and reach in all directions and are linked to the fingertips like threads. They are visible on the forearm of a lean person. Then the nerves quicken and activate the fingertips. The fingers move the pen and the pen moves the ink. Then the shape of Bismillah appears on the paper just as it was in the repository of the imagination with the aid of the senses, especially the eyes, which are necessary for writing. Consequently, the initiator of this action was a desire which appeared in thee. The beginning of all works is an attribute from among the attributes of God, one of which is will. Just as the first effect of this will appear in the soul, then by its means the effect reaches other places, so the first effect of the will of God Most High appears on the throne, then it goes to other places. Just as that tenuous substance resembling vapor is transported by the conduits of the heart to the brain, the substance we call spirit or ruh, God Most High has a tenuous essence that transports the effect from the throne to the pedestal. That essence is called an angel, spirit, or the Holy Spirit. As it reaches the brain from the heart and the brain is under the control of the soul, and in its province and at its command, so the effect of God's will reaches the pedestal from the throne of God Most High, and the pedestal is beneath the throne. Even as the form of Bismillah, which was thy action and is thine object, appears in the repository at the front of the brain, and the action is in accordance with that, the form of all which will appear in the world first appears on the preserved tablet. And as the tenuous faculty which is in the brain activates the nerves to activate the hand and the fingers so that the fingers may cause the pen to move, so does the tenuous essence in charge of the throne and the pedestal cause the sky, together with the stars, to move. And as the faculty of the brain through the connections of bones and nerves move the fingers, that tenuous essence, which we call the angels, sets the dispositions of the elements of the world by means of celestial bodies in their links of light beams to the lower world. They are called the four temperaments, heat, cold, moisture, and dryness. And as the pen scatters the ink and forms it until the shape of Bismillah appears, this heat, cold, water, and earth moves the elements of these compounds. And as the paper receives the ink as it is spread upon it or collected, moistness enables the ink to be shaped, while dryness becomes the keeper of that shape, preserving it, and does not let go of it. If there were no moistness, the ink could not be shaped into words, and if there were no dryness, the shape could not be preserved. And when the ink has finished its work completely and brought its movement to an end, the form of Bismillah, in accordance with the design that was in the repository of imagination, appears with the aid of the eye. In the same manner as heat and cold bring the elements of the ink into motion, the forms of plants, animals, etc. come into existence in this world through the agency of the angels in accordance with the image which is on the preserved tablet. As the beginning of the action in all of the body springs from the soul and then is distributed to all the organs, so the beginning of the works in the world of physical bodies appears in the throne. And, as the first receiver of that quality is the soul, and the rest beneath it are attached to the soul, so that it is thought that thou residest in thy soul. Since the mastery of God Most High is by means of the throne, it is thought that he resides in the throne. And as thou gain mastery over the soul and its affairs have been arranged, thou canst manage the kingdom of the body. In the same way, when God Most High, with the creation of the throne, became the master of the throne stood straight and even. The management of God's kingdom was arranged, and the words came thus, quote, he established himself upon the throne, directing all things, end of quote, and this is from the Quran. Know that all of this is truth, and it has been made known to the perspicacious through external revelation, and the truth of this meaning was learned, quote, truly God, may he be honored and glorified, created man in his image. End of quote. And know truly that no one other than kings knows kingship and sovereignty. If it were not that thou hadst been given rule over thine own kingdom of the body, and given a brief copy of the kingship of the Lord of the universe, thou wouldst never be able to comprehend the God of the world. So give thanks to that king, who created thee and gave thee a dominion and a kingdom, a proof giver of his own kingdom, and for the soul that he made as thy throne. He has made the animal spirit, the source of which is the soul, thine Israfil. He has made the brain thy pedestal, and out of the repository of imaginings a preserved tablet. He has made thy angels out of thine eyes and ears and all of thy senses. He has made the sky and stars out of the dome of the brain, which is the source of the nerves of soul. He has subordinated the elements to the fingers and pen and ink. He has created thee unique, ineffable, and inscrutable, and has made thee the king over all. Then he said to thee, quote, take care, neglect thyself and thy rule, for thou wilt have neglected thine own creator. For verily God created man in his image. So know that and know thyself, O human being, and thou wilt know thy Lord. End of quote. Writing of one kind or another has been bubbling to the surface of my consciousness since the mid-1960s, when I was attending university as an undergraduate. However, it was not until being permitted to step onto the Sufi path in 1972 that the writing process began in earnest for me, first in the service of my sheikh in conjunction with various community projects in which he was involved, and then later on after he had passed away in 1988 in conjunction with various books and poems that, by the grace of God, were somehow brought into material being. All of the latter writings were from a Sufi perspective. However, the vocabulary of those writings did not always assume a traditional character. In other words, on the surface, such writings might have seemed to be secular in nature, discussing such topics as physics, evolution, cosmology, political science, history, legal philosophy, education, economics, psychology, and the like. Nonetheless, those discussions were always informed by and rooted in a Sufi spiritual perspective. The language of truth need not be restricted to the vocabulary of theology. God's truths are capable of being expressed through loci of manifestation of many colors, forms, properties, and styles. To date, and by the grace of God, 33 books, 39 pieces of floetry, and a few videos have been issued through me. The topics are extremely varied, but they give expression to the principles, values, and ideas that I have learned while traveling along the Sufi path. The foregoing body of work is not intended to constitute a compilation of the writings of a Sufi teacher or spiritual guide. Instead, they are intended as the fallible offerings of a person who has been seeking the truth for much of his life and wishes to share such findings, tentative though they might be, with others who might find some value in them. If you are interested in learning how to acquire a software package containing 33 books, 39 pieces of floetry, and 4 videos exploring different dimensions of Islam, the Sufi path, and reality in general, for the very low price of $19.95, then please go to anab-whitehouse.com. I believe the Sufi Reflection software package encompasses a unique set of writings that encompasses a great deal of food for thought on a variety of issues. The following poem is anonymous, but dates back, at a minimum, to 16th century Norman society. However, the poem's actual place and time of origin are unknown. I am the great sun, but you do not see me. I am your husband, but you turn away. I am the captive, but you do not free me. I am the captain, you will not obey. I am the truth, but you will not believe me. I am that city where you will not stay. I am your wife, your child, but you will leave me. I am that God to whom you will not pray. I am your counsel, but you do not hear me. I am your lover, you will betray. I am your life, but if you will not name me, seal up your soul with tears and never blame me. Today's edition of Meditative Thoughts is entitled Curriculum. Many people believe mysticism is just a lot of pie in the sky, cloaked in bizarre rituals. These same people tend to maintain mysticism is highly subjective, with little practical relevance to the real world. In addition, there is a strong suspicion among such people that spiritual guides are flim-flam artists who either want your money or wish to enslave you, or both. Mystical teachings are considered by many people to be come-ons which are vague and confused, promising fantastic powers but delivering little, if anything, which is substantial and tangible. Moreover, many people operate under the assumption there is really no difference between mysticism and either magic or the occult. Generally speaking, people who hold the foregoing kinds of view have never met or spent time with a genuine mystical guide. Most, if not all, of their ideas on the matter are opinions based on received doctrine from someone else who, also, is essentially ignorant about things mystical. They may have come in contact with individuals who claim to be authentic mystical teachers, but who in reality were not genuine. However, just as there is a difference between a counterfeit article and that which is being counterfeited, so too there is a fundamental set of differences between, on the one hand, true mystical teachers and teachings, and on the other hand, pseudo-mystical teachers and teachings. As is the case with all other subjects, there are people who know what they are talking about when it comes to mysticism, and there are also people who do not know what they are talking about and try to sound as if they do have such knowledge. If the audience being addressed on such matters is ignorant of the truth, a false teacher can appear to be as impressive as a true teacher. The problem faced by the average individual who is interested in mysticism is the following: trying to figure out how to differentiate between genuine tender and its counterfeit. A little gift of the gab, along with a modicum of charismatic showpersonship, plus a dash of chutzpah, can dazzle a lot of people into confusion and error. Mysticism has absolutely nothing to do with the occult or magic. There may be dimensions of reality which do give expression to magical and occult phenomena, but the mystical path is independent of and entirely transcendent to such phenomena. Mysticism is not about pie in the sky. Mysticism is about the nature of the reality of our essential capacity and identity. Mysticism is not impractical. It gives expression to eminently useful principles and practices which help us resolve and deal with the problems of day-to-day life. Mystical teachers are not flim-flam artists who have an abiding interest in money and control of other people's lives. Genuine mystical teachers are artists of truth and love who are unfailingly dedicated to compassion and helping people to realize their full capacity as human beings. Mystical teachings are not a collection of rambling, obscure, and vague pronouncements. True mystical teachings are very specific, often in-your-face challenges to and confrontations of the false self. Mysticism does not give expression to the ruminations of fanatical subjectivity. Authentic mysticism is the exact opposite of subjectivity. The more subjective one is, the further from the truth one is. One of the objects of the mystical path is to induce us to give up the many subjectivities which govern and ruin our lives. The promises of the mystical path are rather substantial and concrete. We will have to struggle and persevere. We will have to exercise patience and do justice. We will have to sacrifice our egos. We will have to accept difficulty and hardship with equanimity. We will have to learn how to swim in a sea of incredibly strong undertows of confusion and doubt. We will have to generate not just feelings of compassion for others, we will have to strive to actively and tangibly show compassion for others. We will have to exercise sincerity in all we do. We will have to undergo the greater pain and trauma of the death of the false self before we endure the pain and trauma of the lesser death of the physical body. If, by the grace of God, we are able to accomplish all of the foregoing, then if God wishes, we will attain the peace, joy, freedom, understanding, and love which comes with the realization of our essential capacities and our true identities. Sufi masters have themselves experienced all of this, and their lives give a running testimony to the truth of what has been promised, both with respect to the struggles and difficulties, as well as in relation to the possible fruits of one's endeavors. A curriculum is sometimes described as a means or method used to bring an educational goal to completion. The curriculum of the Sufi path involves a no-nonsense, rigorous discipline which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The goal of the mystical path is to know, love, worship, and serve God in an unceasing, intense, and direct manner. In order to have a chance of realizing this goal, a variety of subjects and methodologies must be experientially engaged, ingested, and implemented in the fabric of one's life. One must study the psychology of the false self. One must be trained in the requirements and nuances of spiritual etiquette, which are capable of not only combating the false self, but also are able to give expression to spiritual qualities of purity and harmony which supplant the machinations of the false self. One must learn the nature and significance of objectivity. In conjunction with this, one must become well-versed in the sources of spiritual distortion, bias, and error. One must come to understand the parameters and possibilities inherent in different spiritual instruments and modalities within us. In addition, one must learn how to calibrate these instruments and modalities so they give reliable, useful, experiential results. One must be helped to gain facility with a variety of practices and techniques such as chanting, meditation, and contemplation. The how, when, why, and what of these practices involve a variety of principles and cautions which are not always easily acquired or implemented. One needs to develop a taste for, appreciation of, and insight into the meaning of the events and experiences which one encounters along the Sufi path. The scope of human potential is immense, and learning how to sort out the numerous forces, both problematic as well as beneficial, which act on us and through us, is a very complex issue. One must learn how to bring balance, harmony, and justice into all dimensions of one's life and one's interactions with the rest of creation. The middle way is the golden mean to a properly ordered life in each of these respects. However, coming to understand exactly what this involves in any given instance requires much practice and struggle. All of the foregoing areas of investigation are part of the Sufi curriculum. They each have important contributions to make in assisting the individual towards the realization of the goal of the Sufi path. Anyone who, God willing, sincerely pursues the mystical curriculum under the guidance of a genuine guide will come to experience firsthand that mysticism in general and the Sufi path in particular are very, very different from what most people suppose to be the case. Such people will come to know mysticism is not an incoherent, subjective, impractical, occult-like set of speculations and theories which are incapable of satisfying the promise of self-realization and direct experience of divinity. The following words give expression to today's edition of It Has Been Said. The people who are most separated from God are those knowers who are separated by their knowledge, and those devotees who are separated by their devotion, and those ascetics who are separated by their asceticism. The following segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is a brief prayer that is offered on behalf of whomever might have managed to survive to this portion of the program. O Allah, give me only as much as is necessary to meet the needs of today, so that tomorrow I might call upon you once more to satisfy my needs yet again. This week's edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life. You have been listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. The host for this program, namely yours truly, is neither a sheikh nor a spiritual guide, nor am I equipped to advise anyone where she or he might be able to formally step onto the Sufi path. When I stumbled into the spiritual tavern of my sheikh, I had no idea what I was doing or how I had found such an establishment. When my sheikh passed away, there were no provisions left in place for anyone else to assume his responsibilities in the future. Since his passing away, I have come to learn, in a very close-up and problematic way, that there are spiritual charlatans who are constantly trolling the waters of existence for vulnerable prey. While I believe there still are authentic spiritual guides who exist in various parts of the world, and unfortunately are becoming fewer in number, I do not have confidence in recommending this or that person as being an authentic Sheikh, which is not to say that such people aren't legitimate, but rather it is to say that I do not feel comfortable in recommending them to anyone as individuals for whom I could give assurances that they are people on whom one can rely spiritually. The contents of the program are intended merely as food for thought. While such food might induce someone to want to journey beyond the very limited horizons of the podcast, please keep in mind that I am of the understanding that the Sufi path cannot be traversed without an authentic spiritual guide. And unfortunately, as indicated previously, there are many fraudulent teachers who are actively seeking opportunities to misguide people and thereby not only muddying the spiritual waters, but attempting to corrupt, if not destroy, the spiritual potential of unsuspecting people. Information concerning past editions of the Sufi Study Circle can be found by going to anab-whitehouse.com/circle, that's capital C, small ircle.htm. Thank you for your time, and perhaps we will convene again in the future during some further, God willing, edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast.